Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Stephanie Curtis. Carrie Miller is out, but I promise she will return. This hour, we are going to be talking about getting older and protecting our family members as they age. We plan for retirement, or at least worry if we're not saving enough. But even if our 401ks are non-existent, we give it a thought. But how often do you actually imagine where you will live and what will happen if you need special care as you or your family members age? How often do you think about the vulnerability? I knew I was going to have problems with vulnerability. I can't even say it. I'm going to try to avoid it, of being elderly and what your rights are. Joining me are two experts on the rights of the elderly. Amanda Vikstrom is Executive Director of the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, and Anita Raymond is Program Manager for Volunteers of America. She's also a social worker and a certified care manager. Yes?
Yes.
All right. Thank you both for being here. Do you have questions or a story about the legal rights of the elderly or about elder abuse? Give us a call. Our number is 651-227-6000 or call 1-800-242-2828. So I wanted to start off talking about because Governor Dayton just last month asked for a task force to look into assisted care facilities because of some abuses that have been revealed or written about in the Star Tribune. And first of all, how many people, before we start talking about how many people end up in assisted care facilities or nursing homes as they age? Is this something most of us will end up being in?
Well, most Minnesotans prefer to age in place. And that's if you ask where we want to grow old. We want to stay at home as long as we can. In Minnesota, we have right around 35,000 people in assisted living facilities and about 61,000 admissions to nursing homes each year.
Okay.
So could be short-term stay back to assisted living.
So will most people end up in assisted care or nursing home or in place? Or we want to stay at home?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's plenty of options for home care services, which is what people want. However, there are, you know, lack of workforce issues. There's difficulties to make sure that the care that people receive in home, that they're able to stay in home. So we need a system and care coordination system in place so that people can age where they want to age.
Yeah.
Whether it's in home or in an assisted living facility or in another type of skilled nursing facility if they need that.
So what kind of changes would you like to see in the task force take on? Or do we just need to reinforce regulations that are already there?
Well, the task force's role is really to provide just a consumer family perspective on changes to Minnesota Department of Health, Office of Health Facility Complaints, changes that could be provided either in statute, regulations to from a consumer perspective. So that task force does not have the opportunity to have, you know, providers or other legislators involved, because the goal is for that task force to provide that consumer family perspective of ways to prevent abuse through regulated policies, changes, or to look at the law and see where is there already a law and we're not actually using it.
That's what I was wondering.
So I think that there will be opportunity for others after that task force comes forward with their recommendations to be able to provide input on whether or not those are suggestions that can work for all.
When you two think about the challenges for Minnesotans, Minnesota seniors, what are the things that you worry most about? Is it the abuse in homes, in assisted living homes, or what do you see as the top concern when it comes to the, I'm going to have to say it again, vulnerability of the elderly?
So at the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, we do work specifically on abuse, neglect, financial exploitation of older and vulnerable adults. So that is our mission and the heart of what we do. So we work with victims every day and their family members. So it is a top concern for us to make sure that people are safe. Older adults, vulnerable adults are safe wherever they are. And we know that abuse occurs everywhere. So 1 in 10 older adults will be a victim of some type of elder abuse at some point in their life.
1 in 10.
1 in 10. And 1 in 24 cases are not reported. It is very underreported. We know that of those 1 in 10 happen in the community and really by trusted family members, friends, people that know or love someone. So I think the Star Tribune articles shed light on a necessary a problem that we need to pay attention to, some issues in facilities, that the abuse that happened to those victims is abhorrent, and the system's response wasn't there and isn't there. However, for family, for people who are living in their own homes and who are isolated and who are relying on maybe one family member for care, who maybe have a dementia or another vulnerability and don't have checks and balances around, we are very concerned, and we see those, we talk to those victims all the time about how do you get out, where to go when it's that loved one or family member that is abusing you. And that is 2/3 of the time it's going to be a family member or a trusted kind of loved one who is perpetrating abuse.
And that is why this is so complicated, because at some points you're talking about the rights of the elder, the victim, or just the rights of the elderly. And other times you're talking about the rights of the family to be able to take care of somebody. At what point do you cross the line into needing somebody legally in Minnesota, cross the line where someone can take over guardianship of you or take over your life and care for you? Where do you lose your rights?
Right. Guardianship.
I mean, it's so complicated.
It is incredibly complicated, and there's so many nuances. Guardianship is really designed to be a reactive response when an individual, whether it's an older adult or a younger adult with disabilities, is no longer capable of making their own decisions. And as a result of that lack of ability, they are at risk or are currently not getting basic needs met for food, clothing, shelter, safety, supervision, and so forth. And most of the time, even those folks who are impaired and would be considered incapable of independently making their own decisions, very often we don't have to turn to guardianship to protect them. We have systems, we have families, we have services that can be brought in to support those deficits. Because indeed, when we do decide that guardianship is necessary to protect someone, to ensure their basic needs are met or to protect their finances with regard to conservatorship, what we're also doing in our desire to protect them is also we are, in fact, asking the court to make a legal finding of incapacity and actually take away, strip them of their many of their basic rights, their civil rights to make decisions, in our social work parlance, to self-determination and autonomy. And we're handing those decision-making rights to a guardian. And again, that is necessary in some cases. It's very protective, but it's also a very blunt instrument to use to protect someone. And the person does, even as we're protecting them, they lose their rights, many rights, not all rights. So it's a very tall, it's a very significant decision to make. And we, part of the work we're doing at my office in the Center for Excellence in Supported Decision Making at Volunteers of America is really to try to promote options of how to build in supports and protections without necessarily having to go down that guardianship road.
Okay. We got some calls, and I want to go back and talk about guardianship a little bit more in depth later, but let's get to some calls because people got some questions. All right. People are calling at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Steve is in Stansfield, and he has a question. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
I guess almost more of a comment. My wife and I are both RNs. We both work for long-term care, assisted living, the whole spectrum. And the problem is that because it's largely a for-profit-driven industry, they short the staffing problem. Facilities are deliberately short staffing. I'll just give you one example. My wife works at a place where she has 32 patients and one aide at night, and she has everything from post-hip surgery to dementia to schizophrenia. And she's tried to go elsewhere, and it's the same staffing levels. It's criminal. I've been in healthcare since 72, and I've never seen anything like that. So my thing is they need to be funded. Staff are underpaid. There's just things that they need to do to, under that environment, the abuse and neglect can just happen out of sheer inertia, just because you can't get to everybody and watch everybody. So,
thanks for calling, Steve.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So, these assisted care facilities that we're talking about, people are moving into them when they're elderly and need help, and they have dementia or they're recovering from a surgery. But then there are also people who are younger who just went through a surgery or they have a mental illness, and everyone is all together and just seems and they're rather lightly regulated, it sounds like.
Well, so Steve's not wrong in that workforce shortage, hours, mm-hmm. pay are a concern for those of us working in the aging field.
Yeah.
And it's a topic, you know, we look to both address at the legislature and through our own systems work.
Yeah, we want to keep healthcare costs down, but you want to pay people well. You want to have the right staffing.
You have to have the right staffing levels, and not only the staffing levels, but the staff working that have the qualifications and the ability to care for the people in our either assisted living facilities or skilled nursing facilities. So they have. The assisted living facilities sometimes might find patients now in there because people choose. They would rather go into an assisted living facility than a higher level skilled nursing facility. But that may or may not be an appropriate place for the medical needs that they have or the mental health needs. So we are concerned about just making sure that staffing levels and quality are there to prevent maltreatment. Absolutely.
And they would choose the assisted living because you have some work. It feels like you have more freedom?
It is, you know, as we age, and if we talk to people who are aging, one of the biggest fears that is expressed would be that we're going to lose our autonomy, that we're going to be, quote unquote, put someplace, put in a nursing home. It's got this negative connotation. So the ability to be somewhere that has more independence and freedom is welcome. If you can't be in your own home, what's the sort of the next step where I can be? And so people prefer it. Consumers would prefer to be in their own home first, mm-hmm. and then sort of in kind of that least restrictive. So we need to make sure, though, that the staff are in place to be able to handle the people that we have living there, and that families and consumers who are coming into facilities are honest with the needs that individual might have.
Yeah. Colin in Vadnais Heights has called in with a question. Hello, Colin.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question. If an elderly adult is placed in a nursing home and they can no longer afford that location over time, is there a policy where they're allowed to remain there and say they cover, like a Medicaid kicks in and continue to cover that, or are they removed into a less expensive or a different facility?
Thanks for your call, Colin. This is a question that I don't quite understand, and I'm not sure, and I've never really thought about it. And it may be coming from my parents, coming from me. What is the answer to that?
Once a person is in a long-term care facility, a nursing home in particular, and as long as it is a nursing home that is registered to accept medical assistance funding, mm-hmm. Which is different than Medicare. So medical assistance funding is a federal program administered at the state and county levels. And for nursing home levels of care in the Twin Cities, for example, virtually every nursing home but about two or three accepts medical assistance funding throughout the state. Those numbers are going to vary too, but most nursing homes do. And so what happens for your parent, your family member who's in a nursing home, and they run out of ability to pay that monthly cost, and it is significant. It's very, very expensive. Once they run out of money or get close to running out of money, they can, their family can on their behalf apply for medical assistance. And they, in most cases, will remain exactly where they are, same room, same level of care. Minnesota laws are very specific to protect people. The caregivers of people in the nursing homes don't know who is private pay and who's receiving medical assistance coverage. So people don't have to worry. There's a lot of myth about the state's going to take my home or the nursing home's going to take my home. That isn't 100% accurate, but people do need to, who are going to be in long-term care and need medical assistance funding, people do need to spend down their assets, including maybe selling the home to help pay for their care so that then they will eventually continue to receive care under medical assistance. It's a much different story with in home care and in assisted living.
Peg in Rochester says, I agree that every place is understaffed. My mother was in a facility for 3 years. She experienced abuse and was hospitalized several times for broken bones. She kept falling. They weren't taking care of her. Then we're making all assisted living and nursing homes and everything sound like a nightmare. How do you choose a place, or how do you plan to stay at home and make sure you get the care that you need?
How do you plan to stay at home? It is definitely, most of us don't want to think about it. So people often don't plan ahead, and that's part of the problem. And then we have an emergency. Somebody has a fall or a significant illness, pneumonia, urinary tract infection, they're hospitalized, and it becomes apparent that at least in the short term or in perhaps long term, the person can't go back to their home environment. And so very quickly, they're in a position of working with that hospital staff. We have to find a nursing home, a transitional care unit, a long-term care facility, whatever is needed. And so we're doing it in an emergency. And so we're doing it based on who's got an opening, who can provide that level of care. It might not be close to home. It might not be the ideal place, but the person, there's a push. The person has to get out of the hospital. So planning ahead is absolutely the best way. And there are a lot of community resources to help with that. There's a lot of resources online. The state has a senior linkage line, disability linkage line. There are fee-for-service geriatric care managers. People can sit down, families can sit down with professionals and think ahead. This is the disease that we're dealing with. This is the frailties of aging. This is what we might be coming down the road. What can we do financially? What can we afford to bring in services in the home? What might we need to do? And if we do have to move, let's start looking, touring places ahead of time, visiting at various times a day, scheduled tours, an unscheduled visit, come during meal times, talk to other residents who are there, if possible, other family members, if possible, just understand the, get past the physical, it's very beautiful and lovely, or it's looking a little dumpy. Try to get past that and look at staffing levels, longevity of staff. How long have staff been there says a lot about the administration and how it flows and functions both for the employees and for the people they're providing care for.
And I do want to be careful of kind of painting that broad brush of, you know, all assisted living facilities, all nursing homes. There are some, staff that work. The majority of our direct care staff work very hard for, not enough money, doing really difficult work and in a really loving, helpful way. And so providers have to be part of the solution because we have family members and we all will, may need some type of care. So how do we, solve the problem that exists without sort of throwing the whole industry under the bus unnecessarily?
We are talking about elder abuse and elder care and planning for your senior years. If you have a question, and it doesn't have to just be about assisted living and nursing homes, we can expand 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Let's go to line 3, Tara in Minneapolis. I don't know if it's Tara or Tara. Which is it?
It's Tara.
Hi, Tara. Thanks for calling.
Hi. So I am a nurse, and I specifically chose not to work in long-term care or memory care for the main reason because the staffing ratios they're not acceptable. On an overnight shift, you can have one LPN and two CNAs taking care of a wing of 53 people, and that's just appalling. And my mother-in-law is in a memory care unit that costs over $5,000 a month. And they, for 12 people, and these are memory care, these are Alzheimer's patients, they have one RN and one LPN and two CNAs to take care of these 12 individuals that need high levels of care because they forget to brush their teeth or comb their hair. And I want to, because nurses, we're fighting for safer staffing ratios because the neglect that can happen or the accidents can happen simply because there's just not enough skilled workforce on the floor to help take care of them. But I would also encourage the family of people who are in these facilities to talk to management and demand more people. You know, that would help our cause because that would bring up the level of care. I mean, I can't understand why a place that charges over $5,000 a month can't have more employees on the floor to help.
Thank you for your call. I appreciate it. You talked about memory care. And what does a memory care facility provide? I mean, reminding to brush your teeth? And is it something that you really do need to be in an assisted facility or a nursing home or a memory care facility if you have dementia, or can you stay at home?
It comes down, the ability to stay at home versus moving to somewhere along the continuum of care, the ability to stay at home often comes down to with people with dementia who need what we call 24-hour supervision. They don't necessarily need hands-on help significant number hours of the day. They might be able to brush their teeth with guidance, but they might need help with toileting. They might need help with safe transfers. The ability for most of us, normal people, it's really the very, very wealthy that can sustain, or some family members that can move in, that can sustain 24-hour supervision at home. So for those folks who just need that intermittent supervision, but around the clock, having to move to a care facility, memory care units are within assisted living, and they're also within nursing homes. Traditionally, how a lot of us think about memory care in either of those continuums of care is it's a locked unit. It's a smaller unit. It's typically locked, and it's typically people with memory care can be on any level, at home, assisted living, who generally need some guidance and assistance. But it comes down to when they have what we call behaviors, which is a misnomer for people with dementia who are trying to communicate displeasure or pain, resistance to being in that overly structured environment might be resistive to cares. So people have behaviors, people who are very prone to wandering out of the building, they get lost. We hear about those stories every now and then. Somebody's found in a farmer's field frozen to death a few weeks later if they get away. So somebody who really needs that very protected level of care is going to need the memory care. For most of the other people we're working with, even people with dementia, can do quite well on a regular care unit, whether it's in an assisted living or nursing home, again, depending on the staffing levels, depending on the eyes and ears and care levels that are there.
Of the people that you said that 1 in 10 mm-hmm. Of the elderly are victims of abuse, are most of them or many of them people with dementia? Does that make you more acutely?
Dementia is a risk factor. So yeah. As you and we do see a higher level of exploitation, mm-hmm. abuse, neglect with those with dementia. But of those 1 in 10, the perpetrators are family members, loved ones, yeah. trusted community members as well. So it's not necessarily those in the units that we're talking about here. It can be more susceptible to being taken advantage of financially. And so the grandson that continually asks grandpa for money and really exploits that. And then the other abuses that come with it. We very often with elder abuse don't just see one type of abuse. We see multiple forms of abuse. So polyvictimization, where there's financial exploitation. So where somebody is taking somebody's money or using it without their permission, misusing a power of attorney. So say I have that authority to be power of attorney over someone, really using that money for something that is not for that person's care or benefit. Along with that financial exploitation, we see isolation, we see emotional abuse, we see physical abuse. And we, especially when there's that familial or loved one relationship, we have a victim who doesn't want to disclose the abuse. And we have a victim who wants the abuse to stop, but does not want their grandson to go to jail. And so they are put in this very precarious, difficult position where they may rely on that person for some help or for some care. They have a relationship with them, mm-hmm. and they're also being abused by them. It makes it very difficult for them to step forward and get help.
I want to talk more about that when we come back, but first we need to go and take a break for the news. Phil Picardi is standing by. Phil, hello. How are you?
Hi, Stephanie. Disney's chief executive says he will work with the chief executive of Fox on integrating the two companies. Disney is buying a large part of 21st Century Fox for about $52.4 billion in stock. As the federal government prepares to unravel sweeping net neutrality rules that guarantee equal access to the Internet, advocates of the regulations are bracing for a long fight. A vote today by the Federal Communications Commission could usher in big changes in how Americans use the Internet. President Trump and Republican leaders are trying to close the deal on a sweeping overhaul of tax laws. The agreement reached by House and Senate GOP leaders calls for tax cuts and the scrapping of a major tax requirement of Obamacare. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the U.S. is in the grip of a fabricated spy mania whipped up by President Trump's opponents, but he believes battered U.S.-Russia relations will recover. Putin, in a wide-ranging interview today, says he is on first-name terms with Trump. Former Trump aides are being investigated for collusion with Russia ahead of last year's election. A man accused of ramming a car into a crowd of people protesting a white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, faces a court hearing today on charges including second-degree murder. James Fields faces many charges in the August crash that killed a woman and injured dozens of others. And a suicide bomber disguised as a police officer killed at least 18 people at a police academy in Somalia's capital today. The Al-Shabaab extremist group claimed responsibility. Another 20 officers were wounded, some of them seriously. The bomber targeted officers rehearsing for Somalia's Police Day celebrations. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:32.
I'm Tom Weber. Stay with NPR News. Coming up at 11, it's the height of the shopping season, and we have you covered on what to get and what not to get in tech. It can be overwhelming. We got you covered, so join us with your questions at 11.
Programming supported by the Shakopee Mettawakaton Sioux community, home of one of the Midwest's largest green roofs, a biomass heat and power plant, an organics recycling facility, and other earth-friendly programs to protect our lands and waters for the next seven generations.
I'm Stephanie Curtis. I'm sitting in for Carrie Miller. We're talking right now about the rights of the elderly and elder abuse. Amanda Vikstrom and Anita Raymond are my guests. Amanda is the executive director of the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, and Anita is program manager for Volunteers of America. And she's a social worker and a certified care manager. And right before we went to the news, you were talking about that most of the elderly who are abused by their own family members. How do they reach out and get support? And the other thing that when I was reading the Star Tribune art series, that was an amazing. One thing that occurred to me was that it didn't seem like the people took the abuse seriously when someone who was in their 70s was physically hurt and there weren't charges. I was wondering, did people think like, you know what, who knows if it really happened, or maybe they were already, you know, they're kind of old, maybe they already were disabled and the injury is not real. I was wondering, how believed are the elderly when they come forward and say they are abused?
Yeah, so we know that, you know, most of our elder abuse cases, you know, happen with a perpetrator, whereas a family member, loved one, trusted neighbor, mm-hmm. somebody in their life. And ageism and the believability of a victim really do go into the response. And people, especially when you might have some vulnerabilities starting. So maybe you have the beginnings of a dementia or somebody sounds mixed up, or frankly, even just who would believe that a grandson would do this or a son would do this to their mother, daughter, grandparent. Yeah. So law enforcement is working on this issue. I know we are working with many law enforcement departments on training them to look for elder abuse and to consider it as a possibility, and really talking to that victim and not talking to the person who may be presumed to be the helper. Sort of, I think older voices get discounted very easily. And so really listening to them. And in many ways, we are with elder abuse where we were with domestic violence 20 years ago. It's not a family issue that needs to be solved. It's not something where a first responder should come and say, assume that, you know, grandma fell. It really needs an investigation. So I do think that we have to think about listening to the victim, regardless of their age and regardless of their vulnerability.
Yeah, I think I have ageism. When I was reading when I was reading those articles and reading about some elder abuse cases, I was thinking like, well, maybe it was already there or whatever. And what do you think, Anita? Do you think that we have some problems with ageism?
Oh, absolutely. We absolutely do.
Softball question at you.
Most definitely. It is a challenge because indeed, you know, the realities of the frailties of aging is the aging body. People do bruise easier. People, bones do break easily. There are physical ramifications, there are physical symptoms and physical conditions where in the process of transferring someone, they can be bruised. In the process of transferring someone, a bone in very fragile, brittle situations can be. And people who do have a, whether it's a psychiatric or a cognitive or an intellectual disability, can have distorted reality. So it is very easy to ignore them and to write things off. We absolutely have to believe and hear and listen and sort through. And there are certainly very trained and capable investigators with our adult protection system who have ways of navigating through and conducting very skilled interviews to sort through, sort out what is something was there already versus this is an actual abuse situation.
All right, I've been ignoring the phones for a little bit. We've got some calls. People are calling at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Justin in Winona has a question. Hi, Justin. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering what the cost comparison was for memory care in-home versus facility-wise.
That's a great question. Can you do it? In-home. You said that you had to be really wealthy for 24 hours a day, but could you make a plan for in-home care for memory care?
You can. Yeah. You can. A combination of wealth is helpful. Money solves a lot of problems, even as it causes problems. A combination of purchasing care, if there are family, community members, neighbors who can help build the bridges to monitor, make sure a person's up and moving about in the morning, somebody that can come in and help with morning cares and getting dressed and getting all the meals going and maybe hire the care to come in overnight and so forth. Costs, if we are talking about having to hire because we don't have informal support networks, costs for in-home care round the clock, you'd be looking at, oh, and I'm going to embarrass myself, you'd be looking at easily $10,000-$15,000 or more. I think it's significantly more than that per month. I mean, it's thousands and thousands of dollars. Now, in some situations for people who are on the lower income level who would otherwise qualify for medical assistance if they had to move into long-term care, there's some wonderful programs called Elderly Waiver, the Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals, CADI program, some different programs that can help pay for some in-home care. But those levels of care, those funding allowances have to be at or less what it would cost for that same person to live in a nursing home. So the caps on those programs are going to be much lower. Again, embarrass myself by suggesting numbers, but the caps in those numbers are going to be closer to $4,000 or $5,000 a month. And so many people who need that round-the-clock supervision that don't have family to fill the gap, elderly waiver is not necessarily going to work for them. And so then they may need to move. So then if we're talking about an assisted living or nursing home, again, that's going to depend by the facility, nursing home levels of care. There are, Amanda, help me, how many levels of care do we have? We have something like 30 significant levels of care. We should have other guests on here who are out there levels of care. So each care facility, each nursing home would say, persons at this level of care, this is the cost. But it is in the hundreds of dollars per day. So whether you're home, assisted living, long-term care, soon enough, you will run out of your own funds and need the assistance.
And I guess I would be remiss to not take this opportunity to point out that many of those programs are, you know, through federal funding. And,
yes.
and many of the programs that we hear about in the news, Medicare, Medicaid, elderly waiver, the tax bill, that if we are going to really look at wanting to make a system that adequately provides for older adults as we age in places where we want to age, we have to fund it.
Okay. Nicole has called in from Minneapolis, and she's got a really great question. Nicole, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have someone in my life who is needing assistance, and so I'm the primary caregiver, but I know at some point I'm going to have to let go of that job and let somebody else do it. What's a good marker for me to know, like, okay, at this point, I can't do this job anymore because I'm the kind of person that, nope, I got it. I can do this. I can juggle 20 things. So at what point do I need to just let go and say, as much as I want to do it, I can't anymore?
Oh, that's such Anita. A personal situation, Nicole, and so specific to contextual to every person's situation. But obviously, thinking about at the point where, it's difficult because as a caregiver, you have rights too, and you have to think carefully about how much of your own you are giving up. Are you giving up? Many people give up employment opportunities. They take a lesser paying job so they can have more, maybe hourly instead of salaried, so that they can have more flexibility. So many times caregivers take themselves out of the job market to provide care, and that impacts the caregiver long term. Most significantly from the perspective of the person you're caring for, at the point where you are stretched so thin that in fact, through, you know, despite all your best intentions, that person is, from the outside, might be considered being neglected. They aren't getting the care and supervision they need because you're stretched so thin, might be some indicators. For a lot of families, that point of when it's time to really either bring in 24-hour care or really think about a move, some of the common indicators get to be, or the points where families can't keep going are when it just becomes so difficult to manage incontinence issues. That's a big one. When, like as I alluded to earlier, that person who needs that, they don't necessarily need constant help, but they really need intermittent help. They're not going to be able to get up from their chair to the toilet and back in and out of the, so that on and off kinds of supervision and help throughout a 24-hour day, that's an indicator that we really, that piecemeal approach isn't necessarily going to work anymore. Wandering can make things very challenging. But again, as I alluded to earlier, there really are some very helpful support services out there for people who can afford to pay a fee-for-service geriatric care manager, can sit down with you, can sit down with the person you're caring for, can assess that situation, both maybe just intervene with you and your capabilities, and talk about how to help support you as the caregiver, but can also do, if requested, an in-person assessment of the person you're caring for and help sort it out. So that's one approach. I mentioned earlier, we've got some helpful linkage lines through the state, the senior linkage line. I imagine you can put these numbers up on your website, but the senior linkage line at 800-333-2433 or the disability linkage line at 866-333-2466. Those are great resources. Too, for family caregivers to talk to.
And just to say that again, it's a senior linkage line if you want to Google that. Virginia from Plymouth has a question. Hi, Virginia.
Hi. Mine's not really a question as much as a request for help. Many people who find themselves committing elder abuse don't understand or see the warning signs prior thereto. And I'm wondering if you could not give your listeners some of the warning signs if they're feeling out of control or whatever they may be in the literature that would help them to know to step back and to make that call for help for themselves before elder abuse would occur.
Thank you so much, Virginia. Amanda, that's because, as you said, most elder abuse is done by family members, and they're not setting out as criminals, career criminals, like, I'm going to do this, and it creeps up on them. Probably.
I think especially with family financial exploitation, people would not consider it abuse at all.
Yeah.
It's sort of this entitlement, or I'm helping someone, and I use that word in quotes. Or, frankly, you know, I'm, as crass as it sounds, you know, I've heard this, they're going to die soon anyway, and the money is mine. But to get to some of the resources, so first of all, they could call our office and talk to an advocate about some of the things that they're experiencing. When you're looking at like actual care, when you're caring for someone in your home, so caregiver stress, caregiver burnout, clearly if you are feeling so short.
And your office is the Elder Justice Center.
Yes, sorry, the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, and it's 651-440-9300, and I have staff who can who talk to victims and family members and concerned people for free all day long. So please feel free to call us for resources. But if you know, in terms of like caregiver neglect, if you are getting to the point inside where you feel you may strike someone, or you are saying things that you know you would never say before, that is absolutely a time where you want to reach out, because elder abuse is preventable. We have to really think about this as when you are helping someone, whether it's financial help through a power of attorney or through physical cares, that person needs to be the center of the decisions that you're making. So are the financial decisions for the good of the individual. What does the individual want? What would they have wanted to really keep them centered? And I think for us, in terms of prevention, when we think about, as we age, Anita talked about having conversations and really thinking about having conversations and thinking about things we don't want to talk about. We don't want to talk about our own incapacity or inability to care for ourselves, but we must. And we should have plans in place as to who we would want to make decisions if we can't, whether that's a power of attorney in place or a healthcare decision, and not picking the people that you feel obligated to pick. You know, if your firstborn child, you feel like I have to pick them, but they have, some addiction issues or have not always treated you the best, that you don't have to pick them. And I would encourage people to think broadly. Think broadly.
And outside your family, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. And having checks and balances put in place so that it's not one person doing all of your caregiving, one person doing all of your financial assistance. Isolation and dependence on one particular person for assistance really can be a trigger for a warning sign for us.
And so, Anita, talk to me about the different levels of turning over your life to somebody else. There's living wills there's medical power of attorney. We talked about guardianship briefly. There's power of, what are all these and what should you set up? If you know that you're failing, that you're on the road to either physically you're getting weaker or you have dementia, what do you set up in place would be the best thing to make sure you aren't taken advantage of, but that your family also has the flexibility to get things done?
Right. Well, first I would argue, let's even step a number of steps back.
Okay.
We should all, anybody over the age of 18, should be thinking about having a power of attorney and should be thinking about having a healthcare directive. A little bit about terminology. In Minnesota, as of 1998, we sunsetted the language about living will. We sunsetted the language about medical power of attorney, durable power. There were so many terms floating around. So we've clarified it in Minnesota. What we have is a healthcare directive. A healthcare directive is an opportunity for a person, any person, not just somebody who's facing disability. Because guess what? We're all facing disability. We're all facing age. That is the constant for all of us. So it's an opportunity for a person when they still have capacity, and even a person who's beginning to demonstrate difficulty, they may still be completely capable of saying, if the time comes when I can't make my own decisions, I want my daughter, I want my best friend Amanda, I want the doctor to talk to Amanda as well as me about what's important to me for my medical decision and my future care. So I'm going to name Amanda as my healthcare agent. And if I have capacity and interest, I may also in that same directive say, and by the way, Amanda and doctor, if I'm in a terminal condition and I no longer can enjoy the things that give me meaning in life, I can't recognize, I can't play with my beloved dog, this is the time where I might not want to have continual curative-based treatment. Give me quality of life. Help me go in a different direction. I can, or conversely, no matter what, keep trying everything that's important to me. So I can list my healthcare instructions in that healthcare directive. That's a great tool to put in place. And Amanda's points are very well taken about deciding who's the best person. Sometimes our spouse or the presumed closest person to us isn't the person that can make those tough decisions for us when the chips are down at the end of life. So we have healthcare directive for medical and future medical decision making. And then the corollary to that is the power of attorney, where a person can appoint someone that they want to help them now or in the future to step in and make financial decisions, manage finances with me or for me. There's a newer movement in Minnesota, too, of something called supported decision making. This is a national movement that we're working real hard to promote in Minnesota about, not just about wait till I'm unable to pull up my healthcare directive. Right now at this time, all of us, whether we have a disability or not, all of us turn to our trusted others to help us make decisions. And this newer movement is saying we can actually develop a supported decision-making agreement that says, never mind if I'm incapacitated or not right now, I want you to honor these people in my life that I want involved to help me make decisions about housing, about care, about what gives me quality and so forth. So these are some tools available for people who are still able and who are interested and willing to think ahead to the worst and plan ahead. And for those of us who haven't done that and now are in a position where there is an incapacity, no longer capable, where self-neglect, other forms of maltreatment, and then maybe somebody might have to ask the court to step in and appoint a decision maker over the money, which is conservatorship, and a decision maker over the person, which is guardianship.
Guardianship, there was a jaw-dropping article in The New Yorker by Rachel Aviv. It was in September, and it was about the rights of the elderly, about people. And this was a criminal case of people moving in and taking over guardianship of complete strangers and being able to get control over their finances and move them about even. And they got the guardianship through a recommendation from a doctor. Mm-hmm. And could that type of thing, like, what can a guardian do? And is this something that Minnesotans should be thinking about or worrying about, is that blunt tool?
There's a lot of there in that question.
I know. There's a lot. Sorry.
We absolutely should be thinking about it. Could that happen here? Yes. That those kinds of horrors can happen. But I would argue Minnesota actually has pretty good, really good guardianship statutes. We have a lot of statutory due process protections such that, and I will qualify, if the statute is followed. The situation that happened in Las Vegas in that story, professional guardian April Parks, who all of a sudden showed up on someone's doorstep and says, I'm your guardian, pack your bags, time to move.
And they were fully functional adults.
Appeared to be, absolutely. In Minnesota, again, as long as the statute is followed, that could never happen here. Minnesota statute is very specific. We have a Bill of Rights for people who are under guardianship and conservatorship, which say the guardian has to consult them, has to consider their previously expressed opinions as well as their own. We don't isolate people from their families, as happened there. But most significantly, in terms of setting up the guardianship in Minnesota, the due process protections are such that the individual has to get personal and mailed notice. Their family members have to get notice that this is happening. They have the right and the expectation for the individual to come to court. Family are welcome to come to court. There's an actual court hearing. There's a court-appointed attorney. Statutorily, doesn't always happen. It should. And that court-appointed attorney's role is to represent in court what that person's wishes are, to be a zealous advocate, not what's in their best interest, but what their wishes are. So it's a much more adversarial situation in Minnesota, which on the one hand can feel like an excessive cost, more stress and pain to the person, mm-hmm. but it's all about protection, so that April Park situation could not happen in Minnesota if we follow the statute.
And I think it's important to think about guardianship as a last resort. I mean, it revokes someone's rights. So if we do proper planning and have the power of attorney, which is, I want to express that, is in effect as soon as it's signed. So a healthcare directive doesn't go into effect until a person becomes incapacitated to make their decisions. It's not in effect right away, but the power of attorney right away. But by having by designating who you'd want to make some of those decisions, power of attorney makes two of me. Mm-hmm. A guardianship, I don't have my rights. So if we can do some of the planning, it won't always prevent a guardianship.
Yeah.
And sometimes a guardianship is necessary. Absolutely. It should never be our first choice.
Lisa and Ely had called, and she has a question that I wanted to make sure we covered. We've been talking this whole time about making decisions for our family. Should we stay with them? Or what if our family is abusing us? Or But Lisa says, what do you do when you don't have a family? No children or brothers or siblings, and you're a widow. How do you get care? And there are a lot of people who don't have anybody. I know somebody who was an acquaintance of mine who was basically on her own as she faced medical emergencies and people who had to step in that were very tenuously attached to her. And what do you do?
When that is a concern, both in terms
as
of...
As a society for them and for all of us.
For sort of that solo senior to sort of navigate these decision-making tools and documents and aging and at risk for abuse. So using even that supported decision-making model, there are tools out there for some solo seniors, but they're few and far between. But really, there are people in their life somewhere. Really thinking about who you have, friends, physicians can help. Senior Linkage Line can probably help with some resources. We can talk through, our staff can talk through some resources about thinking about and strategizing who's in your life that could help you make some of these decisions. If they don't, though, that's the kind of person that would maybe end up in a guardianship unnecessarily.
Okay.
have to get beyond that definition of my family. So those of us who don't have children begin to think, who will I have? I'm alone. But we aren't alone when we stop. Most of us, few of us are completely alone. We do have that broader community, church members, community members, neighbors, close friends. And part of this movement and part of our work is advocating with, they, for example, healthcare professionals to stop defining they don't have family, we better get a professional guardian. Maybe they don't have biological or adoptive or marriage-related family, but they've got a close support network. And we need to honor those relationships too. So an individual who's thinking ahead, who would identify as a solo, is be thinking about building those support teams. Yeah.
So we talked about the medical power of attorney and the power of attorney, the medical directive, and how much money should we be saving? People, there's a bunch of questions here, like, should we be having a pool that's beyond retirement that is also just for, like, where am I going to be living when I'm older? And that's not just, I think that when people think about retirement, they think about, oh, I'm going to be going traveling or this or that. But what about for acute cases where you might be need to be in a nursing home? Should you be spending it? Do you use up all your money and go on Medicaid? How do you plan for it?
So I'm not a financial planning expert.
You are not.
So I'm just going to state that.
I will so certify that.
I think we need more than we think we do. I think, you know, statistics tells we are all under saving. I hear that I don't want the nursing home to get my money, so I'm going to spend it all now so they don't get it, and then Medicaid can, you know, pay for it. We don't have a system that will support that. I mean, we have that should be a safety net, but that cannot be a planning mechanism for all of us, or the system will not work. So I don't have the number. I would advise them to work with their own financial planner, but more than probably they have thought about.
More than
sadly, there's the cherry thought for the morning. Yes,
exactly. So. There are long-term care insurance plans. There are some other tools out there, and that's a whole other show, I'm sure. But absolutely, I guess the good answer is, how much do you need? More than you think.
All right, more than you think. Thank you both so much for being here. Amanda Vikstrom is the executive director of the Minnesota Elder Justice Center. Anita Raymond is program manager for Volunteers of America, and the places we mentioned, the senior linkage line, which I hear about this all the time on our programs about caring for the elderly in Minneapolis, in Minnesota. And Amanda, you also said that people can call the Minnesota Elder Justice Center if they're looking for help as a caregiver. Or a victim. Any other resource you want to get out there?
We absolutely want to get the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, MARC, and we'll have that number out there for reporting suspected maltreatment.
Great. Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center?
Yes.
Or MARC. Nice and simple. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you.